Hello and welcome. This is On Mic with Jordan Rich. Conversation alive and well with creative people who have a lot to say and a lot to offer. As I record this podcast, number 420 in my series, it's been about 6 months since the brutal surprise attack by Hamas against Israel on October 7th. War and strife in the Middle East continues to rage on. And sadly, and with much concern, we've seen the rise of anti-Semitism around the world and here at home. A very dangerous time for the citizens of Israel and for Jews around the world, including here in America. So I've invited two outstanding guests, Dr. Rachel Fish, scholar, warrior, and co-founder of an organization called Boundless Israel, the website boundlessisrael.org. And also with me today is Robin Friedman, one of the co-founders of Tribe Talk, which empowers students to navigate Jewish life on campus and respond to the challenges of anti-Semitism. That website is tribetalk.org. Let's dig in on some very important issues that touch the lives of all of us, Jews and non-Jews alike. Let's begin our discussion now as we go on mic. As a proud American Jew and as someone who has been following the news in Israel for the last several months and even prior, I'm saddened, I'm angered, I'm bewildered. So I'm thrilled to have two very fine people here, Dr. Rachel Fish and Robin Friedman. As I mentioned in the introduction, these are two valiant defenders of justice and speaking up for the cause. I want to start with Dr. Fish, whom we've talked with before in other venues. Anti-Semitism has been something you've studied and fought against for a long time. Have you ever seen anything like this in our lifetime emerging in the present moment as it is now?
Jordan, I think that what we are seeing right now is unprecedented in recent historical memory, in terms of the ways in which anti-Semitism is manifesting in the context of American society and also in European society and abroad and other places. That being said, there were warnings that many didn't heed or pay attention to and recognize that Jew hatred hadn't completely disappeared. It wasn't gone. It existed still. It hadn't vanished, even though so many thought that after the events of the Holocaust, anti-Semitism would become, quote unquote, ancient history. And we know that that is not accurate. So it is fair to say that what we are seeing playing out now is quite exceptional in the American landscape. And for many, and I think for many American Jews in particular, shocking and surprising, but they weren't paying attention to the writing on the wall.
It's a lot like black mold in a home where you don't see it, but it's there. I'm going to get to Robin in a moment, but I wanted to just follow up on what you said. It's unprecedented. How much of it is exacerbated, if you will, by the speed of communications, the social media, the connection that I'm going to say very misguided people are making throughout the world?
I think it is fair to say that with the advent of social media, Jew hatred is amplified and catalyzed at a rate that we have not seen previously. We know that ideas, messages, content crosses borders geographically. It crosses communal identity conversations. And we also know that the spread of misinformation and disinformation, particularly on social, once it is out there, is almost nearly impossible to retract. Mm-hmm. And so that makes this all the more so challenging, particularly when you have a kind of technology, which social media is, that has no governmental oversight. There is no real authority or governing body to check what is being promoted. The social media companies themselves are looking to exacerbate tensions because what enrages engages. And if it will be enraging enough and hate-filled enough, that is actually good for the social media platform.
Very true, very sad. Let me go to you, Robin, one of the founders of Tribe Talk, tribetalk.org. When you founded this organization, there were reasons for it at the time. Now it's really just become an explosion of need. Why don't you define the organization's mission statement first in your terms, and then we'll talk about the problem as you see it.
Tribe Talk empowers students and their allies to navigate the world of anti-Semitism and anti-Israel bias in the high school, on the college campus, and beyond. I agree with Rachel. The signs were there years ago. First of all, anybody who's ever studied with Dr. Fish, like I have known for years. But One of the reasons that I knew was because 4 years ago, we founded Tribe Talk because of the rise of anti-Semitism. That was way before 10/7. And the reason for that is because students were coming to us and saying, you know, I went to college and I wasn't prepared to defend Israel. I wasn't prepared to be called a baby killer or that I was supporting genocide. And just by virtue of my name identifying me as somebody who's Jewish. And they were saying, you know, by the time I was my sophomore, my junior year, I was hiding my Jewish star, my Jewish identity. I didn't want anybody to know. Not because I was being, you know, some of the things that are going on today, spat upon or something like that. More because I couldn't defend Israel. I didn't know anything. And so therefore, I didn't want to be asked to do it. And so they were, when we heard that people were already hiding their Jewish identity, we decided it was something that was worth it to start by saying, look, we're going to create an organization that's preparing these kids for the polarized, politicized situation that they're going to find when they get to the college campus.
It's so interesting, too, that it's not just fellow students and organizations formed by students, but it's academics. It's the power structure in so many cases. And that's one thing you've discovered, that you've got college presidents who are ignoring the obvious, and you've got college professors who are outwardly anti-Zion, anti-Semitic, and very hateful in their teaching practices.
How would you like to be an 18-year-old college student who's on the college campus for the first time this year, who has professors and particularly graduate students who are responsible for their grades and who are doing participating in protests where they're yelling things like, Israel, Israel, you can't hide. We want Jewish genocide. Or, you know, there's only one solution, you know, obviously in reference to the Nazi final solution. Or how about one solution, intifada revolution? And then you're turning in papers and things like that and hoping that they're outward expression against Jews isn't harming you. I know students now who are picking their classes based on not what they want to study, but on the professors. And when schools are allowing, you know, students and teacher professors and graduate students to walk out in the middle of the day and chant these things, I don't know how Jewish students feel otherwise but marginalized and threatened.
Scary proposition, and it's happening before our very eyes. And Dr. Fish, let's talk a little bit about what you've researched on the 18 to 34-year-old Americans, the young people in this country. So unsettling is the fact that they believe in so many cases in moral equivalency between a terrorist organization of killers and an independent state that is democratically supported.
That's exactly right. We have done very serious research on trying to understand 18 to 34-year-olds in America, particularly non-Jews. And what we're trying to understand from these various communities is, what do they actually know about anti-Semitism? What do they know about Zionism? Because as you heard from Robin, they're happy to be out in the campus quad chanting from the river to the sea, and they don't actually even know what river, what sea. And if you actually were to press them and say, do you understand, do you know what Zionism is? What we've actually uncovered is that over 60%, and it's much higher in many of those other communities, closer to 75%, can't even tell you what Zionism is. So they're more than happy to protest. They're more than happy to be part of a herd mentality. And they are happy to put Jews, Israel, and Israelis and burn us at the stake for their witch hunt without being able to actually identify what these issues are.
I'm a student of history, particularly World War II, an amateur, by the way. But you can draw so many parallels with what happened in Germany with the aristocratic, upper class, educated academics getting the young people behind them, Hitler Youth. I mean, it's so antithetical to think that it could happen in America, and yet we're seeing it unfold before our very eyes.
That's exactly right. And when we also asked many of these communities, what is anti-Semitism? Really, most between 40 to 60% can't even tell you what anti-Semitism is. Now, they can tell you if it is a swastika and there's vandalism. They cannot tell you at all when it intersects with the conversation around Israel. And what we are seeing is that there are very high percentages of 18 to 34-year-olds in America who actually subscribe to a position, over 60%, who say that it is acceptable for Israel not to exist. Now, you tell me how many of them would be okay with substituting any other sovereign nation state in the place of Israel and saying, well, it's okay, Poland has no right to exist. It's absurd.
It is absurd. And Rachel, you're hearing this from students that you interact with through the Tribe Talk program. You're hearing about the pressures on them. And these sound like outrageous statements, but we've heard them on the news. We've seen them in protests. I live in Boston, so I've seen the protests and looked at the signs and gotten sickened by them. But it's very difficult for any young person, 18, 19, 20, trying to study and get through school, knowing that this pressure is upon them. And it's illogical, not to mention immoral.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would actually add one other thing, Jordan, which is you don't have to wait till the campus quad to experience this. Tribe Talk knows this very well, as do I. I was recently in a community in Georgia, and I had the privilege of spending time with 8th through 12th grade students. And these high school age students said regularly how they had encountered various experiences with Jew hatred. Mm-hmm. And they ranged from someone taking a scrap piece of paper and anonymously scribbling on the paper saying, Hitler didn't finish the job, go back to the gas chambers, and putting it in the girl's backpack. Mm. It was a Jewish affinity group at a school that was tabling as part of a student group fair. When she left the table to excuse herself for a moment, she came back and found all of the materials for the Jewish affinity group defaced, vandalized, baby killers, genocide hunters, swastikas everywhere. There were individuals who talked very explicitly about interactions they had with other students of minority communities who damned the Jewish students for even suggesting that they were even facing any form of discrimination and hatred, because how could they if they were white and privileged and powerful?
So interesting. Yeah, I want to get Robin in on this too, because Tribe Talk is not just about the college experience, as you said. It's about the middle school. It's about high school. And we've seen incidents, certainly in New York, that are just horrific on tape. I mean, because everyone's filming everything. But tell us a little bit about what Tribe Talk has discovered in the lower grades. We're going to talk about what we can possibly do. Don't worry. We're going to get to some positive solutions here. But what have you discovered, Robin?
So we've been doing a tremendous number of workshops teaching students about what is anti-Semitism. And particularly when it gets to exactly what Rachel is talking about, when it gets to criticism of Israel, what's legitimate criticism of Israel versus what rises to the level of anti-Semitism. And it's always surprising to me the stories that students are telling me. I don't know why at this point it's surprising to me, because I'm hearing them again and again and again, but somehow I'm naive enough to think there's going to be a group of students that don't have them. First of all, almost half of every group we meet tells me that they either witnessed or experienced themselves anti-Semitism by the time they left middle school. Okay, so by the time they got through eighth grade, they had already either experienced anti-Semitism or witnessed it. Now, most of the time, it's things like a swastika, but it's, and not that I'm saying that that's a, you know, an okay thing. It's also things like having pennies thrown at them, frequently having a lot of negative words, being told to go back to the gas chamber. Mm-hmm. Even students who go to, for example, a Jewish day school, tell me that they've experienced it on the soccer field, you know, in the ice rink, on the volleyball court. Over and over again, we hear that students are experiencing this in middle school. And then in high school, the same thing. And two things that really have struck me lately. One is that students are telling me that it is perfectly acceptable, and not even acceptable, but it's socially appropriate to be anti-Semitic. That you are going against the social structure these days not to be anti-Semitic, or at least not to be anti-Israel. And the other thing that has struck me is that many students have said to me, particularly recently, that no matter what they post, somebody will post a free Palestine back. So it's not even anything related to them being Jewish. They can say, I scored my first goal today. And what they get back is hashtag free Palestine. The other thing is that the students feel really frustrated by the lack of response by their administrations. Mm. They say, you know what? There have been racist things that have happened at our schools, and the administration takes it so seriously. And there's usually some sort of assembly or we meet in advisory and we have a conversation about it. And when things happen that are anti-Semitic, there's maybe an email that goes out, maybe not. You know, maybe a teacher says something, maybe not. And they feel like when anti-Semitic incidents happen, that they're not taking nearly as seriously as other forms of hate. And that's extremely frustrating to them. And it also makes them less and less inclined to report them because they feel like nothing's going to be done.
I want to ask Rachel to elucidate on the history of anti-Semitism. And I'm going to use my own life as an example. I grew up in the 60s as a kid. In those days, you had the, well, you killed Christ, so we hate you. This is just anecdotal. I have not heard that in decades. What I've seen and heard and what we've been talking about today is the suggestion that Hitler was right, throwing pennies, talking about Jews and money, and certainly the blood libel, which is a Middle Eastern extreme Muslim point of view. Tell us a little bit about the history. And am I correct that the old school Christian, you killed Jesus trope has faded, or am I wrong about that?
It's not that you're wrong, but it depends where you are in America, if you will hear it first and foremost. So I can tell you, if you are in southern states, it is quite common still.
Okay.
There's a sense that Jews did kill Jesus. There is that perception. There is also a perception that because of the way in which the tradition of Christianity comes in the chronological order after Judaism, that it perceives itself as being the true religion and therefore has replaced the previous covenant between the Israelites and the God of the Jews, the God of the Israelites, the God of Abraham and Moses. And so that supersessionism, the fancy word, that suggests that it supersedes Judaism and therefore replaces it. And that's also where you start to get this secular understanding of replacement theology with a Christian lens, but it doesn't only have to do with Christianity anymore, because replacement theology, the great replacement theory, suggests that you don't want Jews to replace the white population in America. So think about Charlottesville 2017, when you see tiki torches and Confederate flags and symbols of a Nazi era and men walking and chanting, "Jews will not replace us." Mm-hmm. So these things are very interconnected. And I say this because we really do have to understand that Jew hatred, anti-Semitism, has gone through a transformation, and yet each form remains and retains its own uniqueness, and they can all coexist. So let me just say very quickly, historically, and you are right to note, Jordan, that originally the form of hatred you see is a form of what we would call anti-Jewish sentiment or Judeophobia. It is focused on the religious, cultural, traditional identification of Jews as a religion. And that came from both within Christianity, but you also see it within Islam. And it's within Quranic texts and early history of Islam. And that's not talked about as frequently and is very uncomfortable for many in the West to even recognize. From there, by the period of the 19th century, you start to see a transformation where it's not only hating Jews because of their religion, but now you hate Jews not only because of their religion, but also because of their identity as a people. And what's important here to recognize is that the transformation that's taking place is to suggest that even if a Jew were to convert and leave their Jewishness, whatever that looked like, their DNA is immutable. And so therefore, if their DNA is immutable, you still can't like them because they can never fully assimilate into the society in which they are living. They can never be purely German, purely Aryan, purely Polish. They will always be the other. And in this categorization, when they're the other, they are non-white. They are Eastern in orientation. They are deemed to be the Oriental, the Semite. And so there is a racialization process that's happening where now you can hate Jews also because of their identity as a people. And then by the 20th century, in addition to hating Jews because of their religion, in addition to hating Jews because they are a people, now you also can hate Jews because of their identification with the Jewish state and their desire to have self-determination. And when you begin to see, and this is what Robin is highlighting so clearly, when you begin to see that Israel and Israelis are demonized, dehumanized, and delegitimized and held to a double standard, that is not criticism of Israel in order to be able to make the nation state a better place. Now it is about suggesting that Israel has no right to exist. So those are the sort of, I'd say, moments in the history of Jew hatred that we know exist, and each of them continues to exist today.
I did want to bring up something I mentioned at the beginning, which is the moral equivalency between someone like a Hamas killer, rapist, and an Israeli soldier, or just Israelis in general, democratically elected. And here's the problem. It's one thing for people on social media to decry Israel and support terrorist murderers. It's another thing for a Jewish senator, and this just happened, Senator Schumer, to get up in front of the country at the Capitol and suggest that a democratically elected leader of Israel needs to be replaced. I mean, we wouldn't say that about any other country. I've never heard anything like that in my life. Bugs the heck out of me, and I'm sure it bothers a lot of people who are concerned. You can support Israel and still be critical, and whether it be militarily or economically, whatever. But to say that we believe in democracy or we want you to oust your leader. So let's talk a little bit about the problem of moral equivalency on that level and on the base level in college campuses, on college campuses. Any thoughts on our leadership and our media in general and what road they're taking in all this?
First of all, it's so disappointing not to see some moral courage and clarity here. Everybody is so afraid of offending somebody in this area. And I don't know how it actually became, Rachel could probably explain to us how it became so politicized. But the fact of the matter is that it starts with the heads of the universities. And if they're not going to take a moral stand, if they don't show moral clarity, it's not going to happen. It's not going to trickle down. And our students need to be educated. They are not educated now on any, as Rachel said, they do not know what anti-Semitism is. They don't know when legitimate criticism of Israel rises to the level of anti-Semitism. And as a result of that, you're getting these students who know nothing, who are walking around yelling what I said earlier. Mm-hmm. It's a real issue because they don't know what they're talking about. It's become socially acceptable to do this. It's actually socially encouraged in some circles. And so Jewish students are really, as a result, feeling marginalized. And what we need is a tremendous amount of education starting from the bottom up. And, you know, I mean, just two small examples of things that are going on, and it's working in some sense. I mean, I talked to a tremendous number of college students this year who told me that for the first time over Hanukkah, they, you know, they all have electric menorahs and they didn't put them in the windows because they were afraid of vandalism. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I talked to a group of hockey players recently who told me that their team actually joked about taking their names off the jerseys because there were a number of Jewish players on the team and they didn't want them. They were worried about them being harassed in some form. And, you know, the fact that they're even joking about that or thinking about that really shows you how far we've come.
Yeah, well, we saw two college presidents lose their jobs, which was a minor victory because of their absolute nonchalant approach to dealing with this issue of anti-Semitism. Rachel, the moral equivalency question, it stuns me. I just can't imagine anyone who's seen the videos, who knows this history of October 7th alone, the worst Jewish slaughter since the Holocaust, how anyone can have that sense. But Robin said it, we have a problem of education, people who don't know what the hell they're talking about.
I think that's a key issue for sure. We also know that we have seen a shift since basically the 1970s and 1980s intellectually, where facts are presented in a way as being less important than narrative. And narrative has been given a higher privileged position in order for people to speak from their own quote unquote lived experience. And that then allows for very often people to say, your facts don't matter. What matters more is how I feel about a particular issue. It's not that I'm suggesting that it doesn't matter how people feel, but feelings can't actually be the only measuring stick or the metric by which we address these issues. Because very often what's happening is people are sublimating those facts. And what then is created is a world that is completely untrue. It's like when I look out the window and I say, look, it's raining outside today and it's cloudy. And the person next to me says, what are you talking about? I see rainbows and it's beautiful sunshine. And why I say this is because if that's what has happened, which it has to a certain degree, you can't actually engage in any rational conversation because there is no foundational shared understanding of information. And that becomes a very, very trying and serious issue. This goes back to why social media is such a challenge, because the way in which people encounter disinformation, misinformation, or actual information is through their own silos. And we aren't even engaging with one another and sharing from the same set of resources. So that's a huge problem in and of itself. And I'll just say one other thing here. In terms of moral equivalency, there is a real desire when it comes to the Israel conversation for individuals to transpose their understanding of American racial identity onto the issues of Israel and its relationship with Arabs and its encounters with Palestinians. And why that matters is because it creates a very simplistic and superficial framing. That simplistic and superficial framing is the following. Jews, in the context of this conversation, are then perceived as being white and powerful and therefore the oppressor. By extension, Israel is perceived as being a white imperialist outpost that is then displacing the dark-skinned, native, indigenous, authentic population. The Palestinians.
Right.
That is an inaccurate framing, meaning the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians is about a lot of things. It's about ideas around nationalism. It's about competing histories. It's about territorial claims. It's about certain ideas around religion and therefore perceptions of civilization. What it is not and what it has never been is a conflict about race. Never. And Americans do not understand that.
Is this an insurmountable issue in our current day? And I want to go to Robin first, because Tribe Talk has been around for 4 years. You've made progress. It may not seem as though it's progress when we hear about the bad stuff, but describe the progress that has been made. Just an example or two of how the workshops and the bonding and the communication and the support has helped.
First of all, many students have told us they wish they'd had it sooner. We've also had students come back to us and say, this happened to me. And because I went through this program, I knew it was anti-Semitism and I knew where to go to get help. I knew how to report it. I knew what to do about it. And before that, I never would have known. Or we hear back from students, I felt more comfortable having a conversation with my roommate about this, which I would never have done before. And it doesn't always help, but they're given the tools to be able to navigate this climate. And I think that's right now, that's what we can do for these kids, is to provide them with the tools in order to be able to navigate through this. They need to know that there's help available if they encounter anti-Semitism, and they need to know what to do. We owe it to them to give them those tools. And that's what we're finding. Also, a number of students have said to us that the information that they're learning is critical. So for example, a number of college students have told me that they have been told that you can't be an anti-Semite and support Hamas because anti-Semitism is anti-Semitic peoples. And since Hamas are made up of Semitic peoples, therefore, you can't be an anti-Semite if you support Hamas. Now, when they're told that actually anti-Semitism was coined It's a term of art. It means Judenhass or Jew hatred.
Right.
And it was coined exactly to mean that. And it does not mean hatred of Semitic peoples. It means hatred of Jews. Sometimes they say to me, you know what? That is the most important thing you could have told me in the whole presentation. And I mean, kids don't know that Jews are one of, I know this is surprising, but a number of students do not know that Jews are actually indigenous to the land. They have been told by their peers that they are not. And to hear that and to see archaeologically that there's archaeological evidence that it's mentioned in the Torah 669 times, that there's actual evidence that Jews are indigenous to the land is critical for them to know. And when they know that, two things that happen. One, they feel better about who they are, and they feel more confident in their own identity. And two, they have some tools in order to have conversations or to be, if they're confronted, to be able to hold their own. And that's really what we're looking for right now.
And Rachel, Israelis have sued for peace and been involved in peace negotiations. And I'll say this outright, would like nothing more than to be at peace with their neighbors, maybe not friends and buddy-buddy, but at peace. And that's another part of the history that nobody ever examines. They've been attacked incessantly, never started the war, finished them, thank God. But let's go to you for just a thought or two about what we can do collectively as Jews, and also what our society should be looking to do to ameliorate this problem.
I think that there are different approaches within the Jewish community and then outside the Jewish community. So I would first say that similar to how you have to address other forms of hatred, racism, homophobia, Islamophobia, you don't put that on people of color to solve for issues of race. You don't put it on the LGBTQ plus community to solve for issues of trans and homophobia. And you don't put it on Muslims to solve for Islamophobia, meaning other communities have to be willing to condemn hatred in any form in which it exists and be willing to stand up and to denounce it with that moral clarity that Robin was talking about in order to be able to not be a bystander. You must be an upstander. So I feel very strongly that to address issues of Jew hatred, it cannot be solely viewed as a Jewish problem to solve. That's a piece of this equation. In terms of the Jewish community, Robin, I think, nailed it in many ways because of the work Tribe Talk and other organizations know you have to double down on, which is we need to educate our own community. We need to educate young people, but also we really have to educate American Jews between the ages of 35 and 55 years of age, because that is a population in the American Jewish community that, for the most part, did not experience Jew hatred. This was a group that could get into any university. They could get any professional job they wanted, be part of any professional association, join almost any social club they desired. And it wasn't going to be a hindrance based upon a Jewish component of their identity. And that means now that even though they may not have encountered Jew hatred, they are now faced with the reality that their children are, either in real life or online. And what happens is then their children come to them and say, let me tell you what happened. Let me tell you what I heard at school. Let me tell you why the mezuzah was ripped off my dorm room door. And they need their parents to know what language to use, how to navigate these issues, and to actually also model for their children moral courage so that they see how to do it themselves. And so we really do actually need to be able to educate an older generation of parents in the American Jewish community, a younger generation of Jews. But we also have to be able to educate a younger generation of Jews, not only about anti-Semitism, not only about Israel and the history of Israel and the history of Israel in the context of the region, but we also have to be able to talk about what does it mean for Jews to hold power? And we cannot shy away from that conversation because most American Jews are quite uncomfortable with that concept. And what we see is that Israel holds real power. And that means when you hold real power, you make hard decisions. And sometimes you decide who lives and who dies. And sometimes you decide what actions to take in order to protect larger groups of the citizenry. And you have to be able to feel some ability to navigate that discussion and hold that complexity without pushing away or shunning your identity in order to be accepted by a larger crowd.
I think you're talking about something that hit home with me a few weeks ago, or not long ago, during the Oscars, the Academy Awards. Maybe you know where I'm going, when the director of a very fine foreign film, which won Best Foreign Film, Zone of Interest, about the Nazis and Auschwitz, a Jew, self-described Jew, had just some horrific things, in my opinion, horrific things to say about Israel, equating Israel with the Nazis. And what really impressed me, not in a good way, was the fact that it's mob mentality, whether it's Hollywood or a college campus or the halls of Congress, it's mob mentality. Everyone decided to put on their buttons and show solidarity without really understanding what the hell was going on. It's part of the human experience that's not a favorite part of ours, but
Can I say one thing about that, Jordan?
By all means, yes.
Here's what I would want to say about that. If that individual, Jonathan Glazer, if he remotely thought for a second that he wouldn't be burned alive by Hamas, or that his mother wouldn't be raped by Hamas, or his daughter wouldn't be kidnapped and her body mutilated by Hamas because he wants to denounce Israel's behavior, he is sorely mistaken. And I think what you see playing out is that individuals who make these kinds of statements, A, do not understand the vulgarity and the radical elements within Islamism that does exist. And the other piece is that they are desperate to be morally pure, which is a form of narcissism, and ultimately desperate to be liked. And we have to be able to teach our kids, it's not about being liked. Stand up for who you are. Stand up for your own identity. Stand up for your people, and do so unabashedly while always holding on to the reality and the opportunity that you are part of a collective and you have a responsibility to your own and the larger society in which you live.
I'm going to close by asking each of you to talk a little bit about your organizations and the work you do, and to promote, first of all, Tribe Talk. Let's talk about it, Robin. How can people find out more, and what's the future hold? What are you looking at doing?
We are can be found at tribetalk.org. We are working as hard as we can in terms of training both Jewish students and their parents about anti-Semitism, about Hamas, about the Israeli response to the Hamas massacre, about hate in all its forms with respect to that. In addition, we're also working now with secular groups on anti-Semitism, what it is. And we do talk about these issues of, you know, Jew hatred and aren't all Jews white and privileged? And, you know, what are the basic tropes? And we're working with a lot of different groups now with respect to that. And we're talking generally about bias, about microaggressions, about the same way that you would handle any other form of hate. And so we're growing in leaps and bounds, and we can be found at tribetalk.org if anybody's interested. We also have, for those who are looking for colleges, we have a college comparison database with about 150 schools, and it lists what schools have what with respect to Jewish life on campus, including what schools have SJPs, Students for Justice in Palestine, which frequently are the organization that is leading a lot of these protests. So all of that information is contained in the database online. We welcome any contributions or volunteers, and we can be reached at info@tribetalk.org.
It's a terrific organization that came along when it needed to come along, and now it's needed more than ever. Rachel, before we close out, talk a little bit about what you're doing currently and how people can reach you.
Absolutely. Boundless is the organization I co-founded with my colleague Aviva Klompis. We are looking at a lot of elements around research so that we can understand some of the system level challenges impacting the Jewish community around reimagining Israel education and also combating Jew hatred. We have a lot of new research up on the Boundless website, boundlessisrael.org. We are also developing a variety of initiatives around education, specifically for university administrators, for Jewish communal professionals, and Jewish educators. And educators in independent schools, K through 12, because we really do believe that we need to start much earlier. And that work is done in collaboration with Brandeis University.
Educator warriors. I think I saw that somewhere on a website. That's what Rachel might call herself on certain occasions. I would just like to thank you both and know that there's a lot of effort out there to stem this tide. And we have to keep speaking up, and podcasts like this one and others have to do their part to share this information. Thank you both. God bless you both. And
thank you so much. Keep the faith. Thank you.
Thank you once again to two outstanding guests, Dr. Rachel Fish and Robin Friedman. The websites tribetalk.org and boundlessisrael.org. Do check those out. And let's keep alive the phrase and sentiment, never forget. This is Jordan thanking you for listening and reminding you to always be well so you can do good. Catch you next time. Take care.